From the unexplained to the mundane, come join us on a journey to the fringe.
Hello and welcome to Journey to the Fringe, where we're probably just a whole heap of cryptids in a trench coat. Or at least, we wish we were, or something. Anyhow, we are your podcast hosts, Taylor and Chelsea, here today handling a retro-topical topic.
Oh.
In a weird way, it's a weird amalgamation of words. But Chelsea, we've never actually discussed this. If you could be a Bigfoot, would you be a Bigfoot?
Yes, and I'm also thinking right now about how I wish I was just a bunch of cryptids in a trench coat as well. I choose that one. That wasn't my choice, but now you got me thinking the juices are flowing. Not really, because I'm just going with
it. And I'm wondering, if there was multiple entities within a trench coat and it was seen multiple times that way, would itself be one cryptid?
Yes. Who would know, though? Maybe only the few blessed would know, to the people getting flashed by the cryptids in the trench coat.
Yeah. And, really only half the people it was flashing that it was the multiple cryptids in the trench coat, because half the people would look away in
Imagine,
disgust and not
exactly,
know it was truly multiple cryptids.
You're bracing yourself for the trench coat coming open. And how crazy would you sound if you went to Lon Strickler and you were like, I got this story from you and it's fucking weird. You're going to love it. I was in the forest one night and I saw this black figure come out to me, and he opened the trench coat and I thought that I was gonna see a wiener, but what I saw was
one of them was wiener shaped.
Yeah. It was the Loveland frog, the freaking Bigfoot, the Ninjin, all of them in the trench coat. Like, how do you even explain that?
And then it flew away with the Mothman's wings.
Yep.
Okay, so, Chelsea, this is completely not cryptid related, so for those of you that were able to stick through
Why are you asking me about being a Bigfoot?
It's a great question. I should have thought it through better, but that's just, you get the role you get. The topic today is somewhat a two-parter, but really just one topic, in the sense that a Michael Sala episode was really a Stargate episode. This is the Project Looking Glass episode.
I thought you're gonna do Michael Sala.
Well, funny you should say that. You wait till the end here.
Okay. Because I think we did Michael Sala. Was that part of a Stargate episode?
It's really hard to say, and we also did say we're coming back to Michael Sala at one point.
Okay. Go on. What are we talking about?
We are talking about Project Looking Glass. Chelsea, have you ever heard of this project?
Yes.
Okay, what do you know about it?
Nothing, now that you say that. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Okay, fair enough. And it does mean different things to different people. So, basically, what I've done is I've traced it back as far as I can to the original source. We're going to read what the original source actually says Project Looking Glass is, and we're going to see what happens to that story from there.
Yeah.
I was able to find just kind of a general idea of what Project Looking Glass is.
Just a general idea, hey?
I just wanted a Wikipedia, but it's not on Wikipedia, obviously, but a general what is this thing. Project Looking Glass is basically technology for the government to look forward into the future. The primary purpose of Project Looking Glass was to forecast potential future events and evaluate the probabilities of various outcomes. There was a device, and they could use this to display multiple possible futures, which operators statistically analyze to determine the likelihood of events occurring. These capabilities extended to studying how artificial manipulation of wormholes and Stargate technology might influence global events such as wars, natural disasters, and geopolitical shifts. Testimonies indicate that data from the Looking Glass Project was used to predict events such as 9/11 attacks and the potential for an Islamic extremist war with the US, with probabilities assigned based on device readings. There's basically one notable figure that this all comes back to, and this is a guy by the name of Dan Burrish. Doctor's in front of his name, but I really don't know whether or not we can actually credit him to this.
This does all sound very familiar. Are people still talking about this very much?
Yes, surprisingly. Oh, okay. And actually has come up in a very popular podcast very recently that's not a conspiracy podcast. It's turning into one, but it's not on the face of it.
Okay.
This all comes back to the early 2000s when Dan Burrish came onto the scene, basically saying, I have this story to tell. He talks to a guy named Bill Hamilton, I believe. I need to check that name really quick. There's too many Bills in this story, so I have to check which Bill we're talking about. Yeah, Bill Hamilton. Bill Hamilton gets Dan Burrish in touch with Project Camelot.
Oh, shit.
And he tells his story to Project Camelot, and this is where Project Looking Glass starts out. And I was able to find a description of everything that Dan tells Project Camelot from Project Camelot's website, as written by Marsha McDowell, PhD, who ends up being basically the exclusive person who gives the story after Dan Burrish stops giving interviews. She basically does press releases for him. And she's the only one who speaks on his behalf after the mid-2000s.
And do we know who she is?
We'll get to that once I tell you the story.
Okay.
So, we're going to start off with this writing. Dan's experiences with extraterrestrials and Majestic 12 go back 20 years.
Oh my God.
He was inducted into Majestic in 1986 while he was a student at UNLV.
Hold on. He was a part of the Majestic 12?
Oh yeah.
Okay. I don't even know how to react to this. Okay.
Even before he was at UNLV, he had a long and distinguished history in microbiology, working for many years with the Los Angeles Microscopical Society and studying with Dr. John Bunyan in England. So Majestic knew he was gifted.
Was he related to Paul Bunyan?
That's a great question, but he was in England, so I doubt it. That might have been like ancestry since before the family split.
Okay. Yeah, I can get behind that.
So probably no ox. They offered him an opportunity to work in Black Ops, in his specialty, and become well-respected in special applications, and the chance to further his education into areas he'd only dreamed about. So he said yes, and found himself being trained and groomed to work up at Area 51 on exotic biological materials. At that time, Dan did not know that he was in fact being mentored by one of the highest-ranking members of Majestic 12, who felt, and still continues to feel, a great affection and connection to Dan because of the events surrounding Dan's abduction in the early 1970s. While working on exotics, Dan, by then Dr. Dan Crane, I should mention this, his name is Dr. Dan Burrish. He also goes by Dr. Dan Crane.
That's awesome.
And I think one of them's his mom's maiden name, but Dan Crane's apparently his real name.
That's weird. That also makes me think that he's not a real doctor. Because why would you do that? Professionally, I mean.
While working on exotics, Dan learned the tissue he had been studying was in fact extraterrestrial in nature. Dan found that he was being given a surprising measure of leeway while working within the facility. He was still required to follow all the protocols, however his badge, as we later learned, was keyed to allow him access to multiple levels within the laboratory complexes at both Area 51 and S4. This permitted him a range of movement and access to other projects rarely enjoyed by others working in highly structured special application environments. Dan became familiar with a project called Looking Glass, which involved a back-engineered extraterrestrial device originally designed to be a portal opening mechanism for Stargate type travel, which had the capacity to bend time and space so that events over the forward and rear event horizons could be viewed. When it's paired up with a second device using the settings, events can not only be viewed but heard and more. This device was also being tested for communication protocols and transportation applications as recently as 2003 and 2004, before being dismantled for safety measures as we enter further into the highly energetic space in and around the galactic plane. While being introduced to these other projects, Dan began to work as part of the Aquarius J-Rod team, which was tasked with figuring out why the J-Rods, commonly called Greys, were suffering from a debilitating medical condition that affected their nerves. Part of this work involved taking physical tissue samples from the J-Rod housed deep below S4 in a clean sphere designed to support his atmospheric and environmental needs. It soon became apparent that these extraterrestrials were not all that different from us. In fact, as communications improved, it was learned that they are not so much space travelers as time and space travelers, using a small planet in the Gliese system as a local base approximately 15 light years from Earth, where they can stage for their trips here. Using Looking Glass technology, which might be more properly called Stargate technology, they traveled in time from a human future, which is real to them but only potential for us. Dan was introduced into the protocols surrounding the J-Rod by having him be part of the backup team, while his supervisor, Steven, would suit up and go in to do the tissue sample removals. However, the J-Rod began to reject Steven and made demands that Dan be allowed to suit up and enter the clean sphere for the tissue samples instead. This created some immediate problems in the team structure, as Dan was the newest member and not nearly senior enough in time or experience for such responsibility, but the J-Rod was insistent. Dan was rapidly promoted within the team and soon found himself being trained in the protocols necessary for entering into the clean sphere and working directly with the J-Rod. It was later learned that the reason that the J-Rod insisted on this change of personnel was because he recognized Dan as one of the abducted children on the craft he had been aboard that day back in the early 1970s. It is always difficult to explain this, since discussing this movement through time as well as space is difficult. This particular J-Rod had been traveling in the company of a group of P-45s, a J-Rod group originating approximately 45,000 years in the future, who were doing the abduction sampling that day in the early 1970s. He then traveled back to 1953 on a different mission, which ended in a crash near Kingman, Arizona, and was recovered from that crash location and taken to S4 and housed there as a result of the presence on the craft when Dan was abducted, and he felt a strong connection to Dan. Are you following this, Chelsea?
A little bit. This was on Project Camelot, which I think you said that it was. I do believe I am familiar with the story now that you're going through it.
I think it's important for everybody to know this story, though, just in case you ever hear Project Looking Glass. And just to give you a warning, we're going to keep steering away from Project Looking Glass for a while in this story. Dan eventually became accustomed to his new role, but on one occasion, while he was working directly with the J-Rod, there was a break in the protocol and J-Rod took a step towards Dan. This was still early enough in their working relationship that it startled Dan, who backed up and ended up catching his heel on a floor grate and falling backwards. The J-Rod climbed up on top of him and sat on his chest while taking this opportunity to think deeply to Dan, sharing a great deal of his people's history and his own personal experiences with Dan.
That's fucking weird.
This was completely unprecedented and prompted an emergency reaction among the support teams. In the time it took to get somebody else in the clean sphere and rescue Dan, the J-Rod downloaded a vast amount of information to Dan's mind. Dan was unconscious when he was finally removed and spent, as I understand it, several days in a coma.
Because he got too much information.
Yeah, just too much information with that J-Rod on top of him. I'm sorry, J-Rod feels like a slur. It just does.
It also reminds me of J-Rock, and it is a very little known thing. It's not very well known thing that humans can only handle so much information at once or else it puts them into a coma.
Yeah. And actually, that's how the grays deal with us if we get too close.
Exactly.
We're charging them.
As J-Rod found out, no.
It's the equivalent of them soiling their pants to a brown bear. I think that's what you're supposed to do.
I think so, too. He learned that here.
He was maintained in their medical facilities at S4 until he was well enough to return to travel back to Area 51 and then to Las Vegas. Since that time, there have been many unsuccessful attempts to get Dan to share with Majestic what the J-Rod shared with him during that interaction. Dan has refused to say much, but was inordinately interested in our space program, among other things afterwards.
What? That doesn't even make sense. Why, of all things? Like, he doesn't want to share
won't
anything.
Tell it.
But he's like, but that space program. Like, what? Okay.
Dan gathered tissue samples from J-Rod for about 2 years, ending in 1996. The Q94 document, leaked by Stephen M. before his death, is an early draft of a document that Dan and Stephen were writing to go up to the cover committee concerning their work with the King series tissue samples. It's important for many reasons, including a rare glimpse it gives into the way things were done and how they were written up inside a Black Ops project. In the years that followed, Dan worked with Majestic as they needed him and maintained a cover job in Las Vegas. One day, while looking through images of Mars in the NSSDC, the NASA gallery, Dan spotted something that looked like another face on the Martian surface. In the area called Inca City, during 1997 and 1998, Dan worked with Marsha McDowell on a book called Eagles Disobey, The Case for Inca City Mars.
Pardon me.
Yeah, I've been trying to find that book.
Why does this just feel like a whole bunch of randomly connected things that have nothing to do with each other?
No one's that much I've talked about Project Looking Glass, too.
I'm just going to accept it, okay?
The fact that he was writing this book and finding an amazing number of anomalies in this previously ignored region had many in Majestic sitting up and taking notice. They again pressed him for information about what the J-Rod shared with him and whether it had anything to do with his discoveries. Dan still refused to tell him anything. And then NASA announced that they had discovered evidence of life on a Martian meteorite, which Dan reviewed and found suspiciously similar to a small microbe discovered by one of the NASA panelists 30 years previously in Australia, and immediately went on record challenging NASA's announcement. As our work grew closer to publication and became more volatile, the threats started. It was a very difficult time as both Dan and I were afraid for ourselves as well as our loved ones, but we decided to push forward regardless of the risk. Finally, the committee of the majority, the body that had superseded Majestic 12 for a time, ending in approximately 2002, utterly frustrated with Dan's refusal to be stopped, issue a demand that Dan stop his work on the book. And this is the Mars book, too. This has nothing to do with everything else we've talked about. We later learn that they were afraid of how close he was coming to issues concerning the doctrine of convergent timeline paradox, the problems that had been caused by the J-Rods, who were using their technology to travel back in time and thereby creating overlaying time anomalies. Of course, Dan refused. The book was published and released in late 1998. Almost immediately, the committee took action against Dan, causing his PhD degree to be vacated.
Okay.
This was not all that difficult for them, since Majestic had brokered the deal for his schooling to the PhD level in the first place, and they controlled the playing field. The loss of this credential hit Dan so hard that he suffered a heart attack and was hospitalized.
Jesus Christ.
Sorry, you had something to say. I just had to finish that.
Yeah, no, I get that. A quick question. He keeps being hospitalized for the weirdest fucking shit.
His heart downloaded too much stuff.
The J-Rods. Those are extraterrestrials, right?
Yeah, they're greys.
And, sorry, I know I should know this at this point. Why are we calling them J-Rods?
I haven't actually mentioned it yet. J-Rod apparently is like an anglicized abbreviation of 15 light years away. And apparently it is a mixture of like Egyptian and Incan symbols that make J-Rod. That's just what it comes to.
I was not expecting that explanation, okay? Because I'm just picturing...
Chelsea, be careful. You might be downloading too much.
Because I'm just picturing, like, white Trailer Park Boys that are rappers. Small
wearing ones. A do-rag. I don't know why. Upon his recovery, Dan found himself seriously on the outs with Majestic and the Committee of the Majority. Angrier than ever, Dan continued to look for more anomalies on Mars, and we produced two more small publications showing amazing finds on the surface of Mars. By the time 99 came around, the Committee of the Majority was determined to do something about Dan's behavior. They couldn't outright get rid of him, as he had heavy connections with the upper echelons of Majestic, as well as deep connections with the J-Rods, who were in treaty negotiations with Majestic and major governmental bodies. Plus, he also had familial connections due to his marriage into a Majestic family line that reached all the way back to the early 1940s and the Roswell incidents. So, the decision was taken to try to modify his memories by rebelling against their authority. In essence, the entire period of time where he and I worked on Mars issues and wrote the book Eagles Disobey, the case of Inca City Mars, and move he and his family to a new location with new cover jobs in a completely different environment. To facilitate this, Dan was taken up north and underwent a process involving experimental neuropeptides. I do not know all the details. Afterwards, he was placed in Mississippi, where he was supposed to begin a new life. What nobody in the Committee of the Majority had counted upon was the fact that Dan's mind utterly rejected the conditioning, and soon thereafter, he began to experience memory breakthroughs. Fearing for his health under the stress of these unpredicted results, fearing that they might have ruined one of their best scientists, they decided to take steps to reverse what they'd done. Dan was collected and taken back into secure facilities and eventually returned to Las Vegas, where the family had been re-established to await his return. Thankfully, Dan recovered from this and settled back into his life in Las Vegas, concentrating on his research and personal studies. As time moved on, Dan became deeply involved in the study of the Voynich manuscript and his personal research project called the Lotus Protocol. He also became involved in the T9 treaty negotiations through his Majestic connections, during which he was instrumental in getting the number of treaties authorized abductions reduced to zero. So we got him to thank for that.
Oh yeah, I always wondered who did that.
More recently, he started researching the Solfeggio frequencies, and this has grown into a book-length project that he has received the kind of attention of Dr. Len Horowitz and Dan Winter. What started out as a small side project is gathering momentum, as we already have publishers asking about it. We anticipate its release toward the end of 2006 or early 2007. In late 2003, two things happened. I found myself approached by Majestic and Ducton so that I would stop being a thorn in their side and offer the chance to work directly with Dan to help him complete certain projects that they felt were important. Why didn't they just kill me? I learned after my induction that my father was deeply involved as a courier between countries for the Majestic 12, while the creation of the Committee of the Majority was being undertaken in the early to mid-1960s. The other thing which happened was that Dan once again saw the J-Rod who had become his friend at S4. The circumstances are more thoroughly explained by Dan in his DVD, but suffice to say that, in an utterly shocking move, Dan helped the J-Rod use a Stargate device so he could return home. Majestic personnel were once again very upset with Dan over this abduction, but there was nothing they could do. And they don't get into it, but apparently he smuggled this J-Rod to Egypt to use a Stargate there to get home. Quite the story that he left out, and we're still nothing to do with Stargate. or Looking Glass.
I hate that they call them J-Rods.
I know. I hate that. So much worse than Ebens. So much worse than Ebens.
It is somehow. Richard Doty really knew how to name them.
Then in the fall of 2005, Dan was presented with orders for him to speak openly and truthfully about his experiences with J-Rods, as well as his time at Area 51 S4 and his history with Majestic. It was a shocking decision taken by Majestic 12, and once his acceptance of their orders was transmitted back, they stood in adjournment, giving Dan approximately 1 year to accomplish his mission. The orders were also addressed to me and others to protect him as he fulfilled his orders. When we told our associates...
Who's telling the story? Who's me?
That is... And it switches between first person and third person. Yeah. Marsha McDowell.
Oh, right. It was the woman I asked who it was, and you said just... Yeah. Okay. Right. I forgot about that. Okay. There's a lot of moving parts.
When we told our associates of the situation, we immediately received offers of help. In fact, we tried twice to work with people who said all they wanted to do was help. Unfortunately, each time within a matter of months, their help changed into something very different. We knew that the only way to complete our orders within the time frame was to take matters into our own hands. This meant that I had to learn how to edit and hope for the best. The DVD that Dan and I have recently released was done in fulfillment of these orders. Best technology that Majestic can offer in the mid-2000s is a DVD. Dan speaks to issues about the doctrine of convergent timeline paradox and how the Stargate Looking Glass technology impacts us all. It's not just a form of new technology, it is something that has the potential to cause irreparable harm as we move through this critical time in our history. We either be faced with great catastrophe or a renaissance for humanity, depending upon how we handle these next few years, physically, in terms of keeping this technology from proliferating, and spiritually. The issue of the technological proliferation has been handled and continues to be contained by the armed forces of many great nations working quietly together. The spiritual issues are something which each of us can help with. On the spiritual side, we are encouraging everybody to concentrate on unity and to meditate or pray for humanity to successfully move through its upcoming period of crisis. If we go the wrong way, we justify the J-Rod's history books, and eventually humanity will become fractured as a result, splitting off into the forerunners of the J-Rods and the Orions. Dan's so named for the final destination of each of these groups of humanity. They don't quite mention this, but it turns out from his studies, J-Rods were humans in the future from like 52,000 years.
Oh, they left that part
out. Wait, never mind. Dan's friend, a J-Rod who came back approximately 52,000 years in our future, had come back in time not only to obtain help for his people's illness, but to share information with us so we could take the necessary steps to change our future for the better. Sorry, I guess they don't. But yeah, they're humans from 52,000 years in the future.
Okay.
If you feel inspired to help, please visit the section in this website where you can download Unity Flyers. I believe that the Majestic 12 know that there are things Dan learned from the J-Rods during that event in the Clean Sphere, which needs to be shared with the public so that we can make it through this critical time in our history and emerge into our future as a united humanity. I also know that we can't possibly reach everybody, but I am confident. What? Why is she saying that? They got DVDs on their side. It's 2006, yeah. Baby.
Yeah, the technology is so high.
But I am confident that our best efforts will get this information into the hearts. Sorry, and also you've decided to reach out to Project Camelot to reach the most people possible.
At the time, I think Project Camelot was like...
It was a lot bigger, you're right. Yeah. But I am confident that our best efforts will get this information into the hearts and minds of those people who need it, who can use it, and who will help make a difference. This is what the words "tell the world" really mean. This is why we're doing all of this and coming forward now to tell people the truth about what Dan experienced and what he learned of the extraterrestrial intelligences. Firsthand, this first DVD plus the many hours of live and taped interviews Dan has provided to media technically fulfill the orders. Why would you use the word technically? Dan, having met the minimum requirements, is now free to do as he chooses with the rest of his retirement. I, on the other hand, have so much information and taped material left over that I can clearly envision doing additional DVDs about aspects of Dan's experiences that I didn't have time to cover in the first DVD. I am also in possession of all Dan's diaries covering over 20 years of his life, plus hundreds of thousands of images and videos from his research. As many of you know, Dan's health is not good. After this almost year-long effort to fulfill his orders, together. He actually mentions that every time he speaks, how where he might be dying. He suffered another seizure and he is still very ill with the aftermath. It caught us all by surprise and forced us to put the brakes on the one-on-one telephone chats Dan had started to do with interested people from the community. Hopefully, those will be able to start again once he feels better. But everything will depend on Dan's health. One way or another, all the promises that Dan and I have made about disclosing information to the public will be honored and the charitable contributions as outlined by Dan will be made. One thing I do know is Dan is a fighter. He has been through more hardship than any 10 people I know put together and he still keeps fighting. I think he should serve as the inspiration to everybody. Never give up. Stay true to yourself. Keep your honor intact. Do what you know is right, even if it's inconvenient, and keep pressing forward no matter what others say. Written September 2006 by Marsha McKay. Chelsea, what do you think of that story?
My question is, why the hell would we be interested in Dan's interviews, Dan's journals, Dan's anything, if he never is going to spill what the J-Rod told him? I feel like that's the information we want, and he doesn't want to give that information.
Yeah. And so like, he's not going to tell Majestic. He can't say it anywhere because it will get back to Majestic no matter what.
Exactly. You can't tell anyone outside of that because, I mean, Majestic's more secret than telling Project Camelot. So what do we want with Dan? Nothing. Dan is just constantly in the hospital for weird shit.
I find it kind of hilarious that he doesn't really talk about Looking Glass all that much either, but he is where we kind of point to get to it. It almost feels like he thought the big story was going to be the J-Rods, but like, you've heard of Project Looking Glass. Chelsea, I don't think you've ever heard the term J-Rod before.
I think that I probably have, but I just blocked it out.
Okay, yeah, because it's a bad name.
Here's the thing with these people. They take one idea and they go, yeah, I'm going to say that I was a part of the Majestic 12, and then they just expand outwards from there and they're just building upon other people's piles of bullshit. And how you can tell that this is so old is because Corey Good is not involved. And so you can elaborate on other people's ideas and they'll be like, yeah, see, it's true. But Corey Good would be like, that's my idea. You can't fucking say that you were in the space program.
Yeah.
Only I can.
Because I lied about it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my fucking idea.
Or sorry, I lied about some, but I don't tell you which so that I can sue you.
So this is a little bit nostalgic in that way as well, where there is a million different things that we already know or well-known lies within what they're talking about. And who is this woman? Are you going to tell us?
You can't find anything else about her. Your only connection you'll ever find, Marsha McDowell, is through Dan Burrish. I can't find anything about her, and her only writing credit is a co-author on that Mars book.
So she's just essentially...
Like, she might not be real. I don't know.
What is her stats or whatever you would call it that she is telling, like working on his behalf? Nothing? Just...
She's got a PhD apparently, but okay. I should say I couldn't find anything about her outside of like her writing for Nan Burrish. Mm-hmm. I also can't find any educational credentials with schools for Dan Burrish, but as he mentioned, Majestic 12 took it away, so... Very convenient and weird that they can just alter school records.
Yeah, so weird.
Yeah, if you want to go look, there's a bunch of his interviews on YouTube. I find him to be a very odd guy. He's kind of weird looking, kind of, I don't know. I just get weird vibes from him.
You give him a 10 for vibes?
He's not the oldest person in the UFO community to reference Project Looking Glass. I'm going to share my screen with you. This bad boy right here.
That guy looks so familiar. Who? Bob Lazar. Yeah.
Project Looking Glass had to do with time, any effects of time in the craft. I don't think we're not talking about making a time machine like in science fiction, but we're talking about, you know, small distortions, intentional distortions of time, and how that can be used.
Oh my God. That guy that you just showed me, he comes.
Yeah, Geisinger?
Yeah, he's on my next episode.
Okay. Weird that he came up twice. But Chelsea, so that was when Bob Lazar was on Joe Rogan, he referenced it. But you notice it didn't quite have the same kind of feel to it. He was talking about very small changes in time. It's not a time machine, it's a distortion of time.
Yeah.
For the flight of UFOs. And he actually talked about this in 1989.
Could you briefly describe Project Looking Glass and Project Sidekick for us?
Project Looking Glass dealt with the distortion, the fact that there's a time distortion. Essentially, looking back in time, and by that I do not mean looking back years ago to see the wagon train days. They're looking for distortions that are milliseconds in time, and what that was used for, I don't know. But that was just observing the time, the time distortion, time dilation phenomena of the craft in operation.
Oh, that's not what the other guy said. I hate this video. What am I looking at? There's no focus. It's jumping all over the place.
It's an interview, so they're showing UFO related topic. So yeah, like if you notice, like what Bob Lazar is describing as what Project Looking Glass is not in any way how Dan Burr is describing it. Bob Lazar is describing it as like millisecond time dilations. Or is this is like, no, we're looking into the future to see different futures and try to make one come out. So, like, he's not the first person to talk about it, but when you talk about Project Looking Glass and it being something to look in the future, Dan Burrish is the first person to talk about it. Bob Lazar goes back to 89
okay.
with this idea. Now, there is one other person that kind of comes on as a whistleblower for Project Looking Glass. Not is a whistleblower of somebody involved with it, but somebody in passing. And his name is Bill Wood, or at least his alias is Bill Wood. He comes on, again, Project Camelot. Before this episode even starts, they have to deal with the controversy of Bill Wood. And Chelsea, brace yourself for what you're about to see, because we're going to look at this episode.
This makes me so excited.
So, Bill Wood is in the top left. Top right, David Wilcock. A young and scrappy David Wilcock in 2012.
Why is he here?
Because... Chelsea, just before we get too far with Bill Wood in this, whenever you see an interview or somebody talking about Bill Wood, they'll say he has some controversy in his past. And they are going to address the controversies okay. right off the bat, and they get real awkward really fast.
Okay.
Basically, what I want to say to everybody out there who's doubting, you know, my credentials and what I did in the military, all I can say is I'm completely fine with that, because... I don't have evidence that there is a SEAL Team 9. I think it's pretty plausible that people recognize that the Navy didn't just forget the number 9 when they were making SEAL Teams. And up until very recently, SEAL Team 6 didn't exist either. So there's a lot about what I did that is considered above top secret. And I'm sure everybody would agree that after 9/11, those records were probably scrubbed clean from ever existing. So that's what I have to say about that. I would like to recognize that after my interview, I did have the opportunity to talk to David after that. And David and I have since talked for many, 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 many hours. And
that's correct.
We were absolutely thrilled to find out that we have been working in tandem without ever knowing it. And that when we compared notes, we were strangely thrilled that what he's been doing with his work and what I've been doing with my work were jiving together now. And we have since been able to get a lot of work done.
I guess I'll also say here that I have plugged Bill into the Insiders Network that I'm a part of, which has expanded, and I was able to put him in touch with people who would have eaten him for breakfast if he was fake, and they were very impressed.
So he says he was part of SEAL Team 9, which doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And he says he has no evidence that SEAL Team 9 exists.
Okay.
Okay, and lastly, I have people, obviously a lot of Navy SEALs, and there is a rumor mill out there that's really going full force as a result of actually some of those probably Navy SEALs, maybe well-meaning as they may be, who simply do not understand, well, they don't even know that Osama bin Laden was not killed by SEAL Team 6. He actually died many years ago, and that's documented, but it's documented more in the, if you would call it, the conspiracy or so-called conspiracy areas that we deal with on a daily basis. But people do not understand the relationship you had with this, if you want to call it that, with the 16-year-old girl. Now somebody is writing to me that the girl was 12. Can you please address that?
And tomorrow she'll be 11, that? And that day after that she'll be 8.
Yeah.
You know, these people don't show any information. It's just talk. They don't show any proof. They don't even show their faces. So, you know, okay. I don't care.
I understand.
David Icke taught me that.
Okay. But in the interview, basically, I just want the facts on the table in this live stream so that we can get on with it. You know what I'm saying? And the facts are that you had consensual sex with a 16-year-old and you were 25 at the time, that it was not against the law where you were located, which I understand was, I believe, San Diego, but clarify it.
Let me stop you there.
Go right ahead.
It has been since pointed out to me that it may have been against the law. So I will amend my statement and say this. I was not tried in the state of California, even though this incident occurred in the state of California. I was tried by the military, even though proper protocol and procedure would say that I should have been tried by the state of California.
You were tried 2 years after the fact. Yeah. The military went back 2 years to find this incident and then charge you. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the incident occurred long before my court-martial occurred, yes.
Okay. So at this point, I think that we've covered the most controversial areas that the SEAL teams out there, the various Navy SEALs, et cetera, are concerned about.
Yes, that's the controversy that people say that he is surrounded by. Statutory rape.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they all just say it's consensual. I've never heard an interview with the other side of it. I don't know if there is such thing as consensual sex with a 16-year-old when there's a 25-year-old involved, but that's where it is.
There isn't. Yep.
Okay. Anyhow, it goes on and David Wolcock finally takes over at one point and he starts telling us how this all lines up with what he's being told, and Bill Wood changes the story so that basically Project Looking Glass hit a brick wall where they couldn't see forward in time past 2012, which meant something big was going to happen. And that's
right.
Yeah, no
I
matter what,
this.
They couldn't see past this time. And that's where David Wilcock comes in and Project Camelot. And they're like, yes, the 2012 phenomenon. We're going to take it. It's perfect.
Yep.
So David Wilcock's here because he's there to basically be the 2012 convergence person.
Yeah. How is he still around?
Who freaking knows? This, by the way, is Dan Burrish.
Oh yeah,
he gives Sylvia Kill vibes.
That's a creepy
right
dude
there, yeah.
Right there. Oh yeah,
and yeah.
Oh no, I don't.
Oh no,
want
you have to because Candace Owens is the reason we're actually talking about this. Because guess what? She's on Team Project Looking Glass as a thing as of right now. I just need to look up.
I really dislike.
Oh yeah,
Candace
she's an awful,
Owens.
Horrible human being.
She
but she
really
starts
is.
Off right here. Talking about why we got to talk about Project Looking Glass. And it's because there's a commercial.
This ad?
Yes. Because of this beautiful leather belt.
It is an absolute fact that Charlie Kirk thought that he was a time traveler. He told me he was a time traveler repeatedly. I showed you guys that text message exchange. I said to him response that I didn't feel the same way and that I thought I was from another planet, that I was an alien my entire life. Just do not get it here. This planet is ghetto. That's how I feel. I don't understand it. The rules don't make sense.
Is she just going off the rails?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
Anyways, this brings us obviously to the CIA's Project Looking Glass. Essentially, there were these whistleblowers, like I told you, in the military.
Yes, and I want to remind you, whistleblowers, Dan Burrish and Bill Wood
had a technology.
That's it.
Which they stole, of course. Please do not miss the part that I keep explaining to you. These people are not smarter than you. They're not. They're just more evil. They steal. They plunder and they steal things. And then they rewrite history and pretend that they were geniuses. anyways, they have a knack for murder. They have a knack for theft. And this time, just like a lot of times before, they stole a device from the ancient Sumerian civilization that's located in modern day Iraq. A very advanced civilization. They're obsessed also with Egyptian civilization, as we discussed yesterday. The Satanists kind of taking reintroducing these things. First, they keep them to themselves. They hoard these things, and then they kind of give us. So they steal this piece of technology, and they incorporate it into a computer. And suddenly, they're apparently able to predict future outcomes. Just imagine the deep state being able to look into a glass, so to speak. The Sumerian culture was known for their advancement in glass, and to see different outcomes. I mean, the amount of power that you would have, and then also fathom in your mind that the people that are Satanists have this power. But to bring this back to my earlier point about all of these things that are happening or have happened that are seemingly inexplicable, it just lives inside of me that Charlie Kirk knew he was going to die. How? How was he so certain that he was going to die young? How is that possible? How was he even able to describe it as this tragic event? How did he know? How was he certain, by the way, as he said in those messages, that from the moment he signed onto the dotted line to begin Turning Point USA, he knew he was going to die. He knew his death was going to be related to Turning Point USA. That's not a coincidence.
Yeah. Absurd to be a coincidence. Not absurd. Project Looking Glass as the reason for Charlie Kirk's assassination, for he saw it. Not absurd.
We were all...
And Chelsea, Michael Sala, in fact, might have the best answer for it.
Oh, Dan Burrish.
He had a whole essay. I'm taking the conclusion for this.
And I please, Michael Sala. I would rather listen to Michael Sala than Candace.
Yes.
Owens.
Oh, any day of the week. Dr. Michael Sala wrote this in-depth article about Dan Burrish, and Dan's like this. In conclusion, the Burrish case will undoubtedly continue to raise controversy due to the polemical positions taken by supporters and critics of his public disclosures. I don't know. He likes his fancy words. Polemical. Okay. There is a need to discern what is valuable in Burrish's disclosure of classified technologies and to separate it from the disinformation designed to distract and confuse researchers. This is especially important when it comes to the topic of Stargate technology and likelihood that such technologies drive geopolitical events such as 91 and 2003 military interventions in Iraq. If Stargate technologies exist to the extent Burrish describes, and this is technology that he directly experienced, it is important to consider his testimony on its merits. The growing scientific interest in the feasibility of traversable wormholes, time travel, or Stargate technology makes it important to consider whistleblower sources from the classified world describing the existence of such technologies and their varying applications. He thinks it's important to look at him, but he's like, I can't actually tell if it's true or not. Which is really weird for Sala to say.
I was just gonna say that.
Because, like, his whole thing is take it at face value and just run.
Of all things, the only doctor in the story. The only actual doctor.
And yeah, it's a way longer document from Michael Sala on that one. I would have played, like, what he said about him, but I there's a lot of clips. So I thought I could just do that, and man, he's a long-winded individual. And Chelsea, yeah. Of course, no episode would be complete of looking who has spoken on this if we didn't go to this man right here.
I knew it. I didn't.
And he's talking about this in 2025. Yeah, he shaved his little mustache.
Look at him. He's got his hair combed over all nice.
He's showing up proper. Sorry, this is Richard Doty. He has shaved his mustache. He put on the thick glasses.
He looks like freshly showered.
Oh, and sorry, before we get to this part, I gotta play this because this annoys the fuck out of me. So this is the intro for Richard Doty.
Mr. Richard Doty, very happy to have you on, sir, as a master sergeant, a retired master sergeant who served as a special agent with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, also known as AFOSI. So if you hear that acronym, that's what it means today. Where Rick specialized in counterintelligence and the protection of highly classified programs. During his tenure, Mr. Doty was read into two special access programs known as SAPs and partially read into another 12, granting him a very, very rare insight into deeply protected operations involving UFOs and non-human intelligence. Following his retirement, Mr. Doty became a prominent, if not controversial, figure in the UFO research community. He has since stepped forward as a whistleblower, sharing firsthand knowledge from his intelligence background and contributing to influential works such as Exempt from Disclosure with Robert Collins. Doty's career and testimony have been featured in numerous documentaries and TV series, including the acclaimed Mirage Men, which explores disinformation campaigns. He also appeared in the J.J. Abrams-produced Showtime docuseries UFO in 2020.
This episode has made me learn, if somebody says controversial in a description of somebody, you gotta fucking go look up the controversy, because they will not tell you what they're meaning by it.
Yep. I would agree.
Richie D just has a little bit of controversy in his past.
just a little bit
of controversy.
Same with Bill, what's his face from
Bill Wood. Just a little controversy in his past.
Just a little bit of controversy. I love how he's fidgeting on his chair right now.
He's just waiting.
You think his legs are
This is an hour 50, Chelsea. He needs recess. So yeah, Richard Doty has talked about this too, adding support to the whole thing. And
always bring in Doty to give you bring in the credibility.
Chelsea, I also need to tell you that I did find this website called the Burrish Archive, which is basically this guy was so passionate about the Dan Burrish story that he had to make a website about it. And so passionate about it, in fact, he had to have AI create podcast episodes of the Burrish Archive for him.
What?
Super weird.
Very weird. Okay, can we play a little bit? I've never heard an AI podcast, I don't think. Immense,
which is exactly why a methodical, you know,
how do you know this is AI?
Because I've had AI make me a podcast before. It sounds exactly like this.
So our mission today is to chart this incredibly complex narrative chronologically, from his recruitment through his work at the infamous S4 facility, and I think most importantly, look at the corroborating evidence.
Right, the pieces that have been brought forward.
It's got AI feel, right?
Including the Burrish archive itself.
Yeah.
Exactly. We need to lay this story out piece by piece.
So yeah, this guy's obsessed with it. Skeptic, and through it, I actually learned that...
But not obsessed enough to make his own podcast.
I know. Anyhow, this ended up making me learn about the storyline of Dan Burrish and how he's actually still alive today. And in fact, still maintains his own website, Chelsea. It is eaglesdisobey.net.
Uh-huh.
And it is so freaking confusing.
Right on. This is big Canada flag.
Waving Canada flag. Doesn't move in
is
any way.
Is he Canadian?
Don't think so.
Okay.
Next up, Eagles Disobey.
I guess he's just trying to get on the good side of everybody. Yeah. This is a stereotypical UFO website.
It is, but there's no ads. Yeah. There's nothing to click on anywhere at all.
Did you highlight everything?
I highlighted everything. There's nothing. I believe Eagles Disobey DNM's flagship website mean Dan and Marsha's, and all projects are ongoing. Secret squirrel on duty.
Where did the squirrel come
from?
I
don't know. And I love that there's eagles flying around Mars. Some type of NASA thing, a lighthouse.
I really hope that's not the secret space program, because we should be reporting that to Corey Good. Really fucking hope.
I shouldn't say there's anything to click on. There's one thing to click on. It's a YouTube video for Everyone's Gone to the Moon by Jonathan King. And yeah, okay. It's copyrighted 2026 by Lady Marsha Ann, PhD, which I have to assume is Marsha McDowell. All rights reserved. That's the website.
Is this it?
Yep, that's it.
I don't know what to think about that.
Anyhow, every time you hear Project Looking Glass, it goes back to those two people. First guy's really weird, and the second one is a statutory rapist.
Huh. And the statutory rapist guy with connections to David Wilcock.
And SEAL Team 9.
He came after
after. And potentially you can trace it back to Bob Lazar, but it seems like a completely different Project Looking Glass that he's talking about.
But Bob Lazar does tie it to MJ-12, did he
not? Yeah, he did. Oh, and I should say also on here they do have MJ-12 is like, where is it?
Does this guy have anything good to say, this guy who is obsessed with the AI?
I was torn. I was actually going to read his summary of everything, but then I was like, no, I got to read Marsha's. Marsha's is better.
Marsha's at least seems like it probably wouldn't be AI. You never know about this.
Somewhere on this page, he had the Majestic 12 on here. This is the guy who did it, Brian Jackson. He said he was a fan of Bill Hamilton's investigative work, who was the first person to talk to Dan Burrish. But Bill Hamilton's also an exopolitics guy. So that immediately is like, oh, that's bad.
Did Burrish ever comment on the other statutory
work? Burrish never talked about Bill Wood, no. But they never worked together or knew each other, so I understand why.
Okay. I mean, one could add credence to the other, I guess. Yeah.
Sorry, I was just trying to find... He had a Majestic 12, and it was like everybody that was in Majestic 12, and Dick Cheney was like MJ1. Where can I not find that?
Because you're trying to find
it. Yeah, that's a fair point. Anyhow, Chelsea, any questions?
Lots. That was a roller coaster of a lot of things. We saw everybody. You always gotta love, and we see it come up a lot where things get stacked upon each other. People add to stories and stuff like that that are starting with something.
People that are nice in the community and don't copyright their work.
Yeah, we've only come up against the one that we know of so far.
I suspect there's another one who's done it too.
Maybe. It kind of unravels when the original person with the original story kind of comes forward and says that everything that I did was disinformation. And I was being actively fed disinformation to disseminate it into the community. So everything else kind of unravels from there. But then you get all these people who just kind of want to add to the story and make themselves a part of it.
I especially find with Dan's original story, like the 2012 story does not make any sense because like J-Rod comes from 52,000 years in the future. So why would we run into a hiccup at 2012? Doesn't make any sense.
And you're going to see stuff like that when it's made up.
Yeah.
Wow, that was a roller coaster that I wasn't expecting. And I do definitely remember this from when I was younger, watching this. I used to watch Project Camelot all the time. Another one that we need to do an episode on. You're really looking for that.
Hey? I'm looking hard. I can't find it.
Oh, go up, go up, go up. I've watched this one. Okay. 2007. I watched
I hope one. You're all the wiser now and can kind of sniff out any time somebody mentions Project Looking Glass. If not, at least it was a fun story with a J-Rod.
Oh, that was a fun
story. I've been Taylor, here with Chelsea. We are Journey to the Fringe. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
So bye. This was the testimony of Dan Burrish, and he gave you the coordinates exactly where it is in the top left. Heavily armed Spec 4, those are soldiers. Camera and audio stands. The pylons are around this device. There's a gate and a ring. So, again, here's the actual picture that he drew of this Stargate. Now, what you're seeing there, again, is... there's three pylons. Let's go back one more just to... So you got these three pylons, okay? And then you see what looks like gears around them. Those gears are not physical things. They are somehow energetic structures that you physically see. But the point is you have a triangle of them. There's a triangular area of these three pylons. And then in between where you have the two red discs there, you have one of these barrels of water. And you have to zap it with electromagnetic energy again. And then what does it do? It creates this slate gray ring. You can't see anything but the slate gray color. But yet when you walk through it, you will travel to another place. And then you also notice there, he has those little canisters at the bottom. Those are argon gas canisters because the whole technology requires argon gas to work. Argon is very useful for what we call charge clusters. We'll get into that in another talk. So again, he says here, area containing three rings on a gyro driver device. I already showed you that before. And then there's the two red discs in between that apparently help to stabilize this. And then he said that you walk through an area of strange perception. It's like you're hallucinating. Things get very strange. The other weird thing, as I said before, is that the barrel can be tilted. And so if you have the barrel tilted upright, like you see at the top, you get the looking glass configuration where you can look into the future, but you can't go through it. If you tilt the barrel relative to Earth's gravitational field, you get this slate gray ring, which you see more towards the bottom. And then it works as a Stargate. Now, there's a whole lot of stuff that I could talk about with this. This really, really blew me away.